Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Labor unions called it a disaster. A former U.S. senator said it was a defeat for democracy. And even President Obama chimed in on the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision regarding campaign finance, saying it opens the floodgates for corporations to influence the outcome of political campaigns. On January 21st, the High Court released its decision in a case known as Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. The justices, by a 5-4 majority, relaxed certain rules on how much companies, nonprofits, and unions can spend on so-called advocacy ads. These are the messages you see all over television in the final days of a campaign funded by groups outside that campaign, but they also can be full-length movies criticizing a candidate or praising him or her, like the one against Hillary Clinton that sparked this decision. The case sprang from a conservative advocacy group called Citizens United, which had wanted to distribute an anti-Hillary Clinton documentary during the last presidential primary, but was told it could not under current campaign finance law. The dispute ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court, and Citizens United won. Today in The Exchange, we'll dig more into this court ruling and what impact it may have on how our elections are conducted. And let's hear from you, too. Exchange listeners, how do you see this court decision? A victory for free speech or a setback to democracy? Call in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We have two guests. MIFB in studio is Dan Weeks. He's president of Americans for Campaign Reform, a national group based in Concord, New Hampshire. And Dan, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Joining us from D.C. is John Samples, director of the Center for Representative Government at the Cato Institute in Washington. And John, welcome back to you, and thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, and John, to you first, even under our current campaign finance laws before this decision were flooded with ads in the days before election. How does this new ruling change that in terms of how much advertising we might see and who's behind those ads in terms of businesses or unions or nonprofits?
The only thing that legally changes after this decision is this. It's one simple change. People could always run ads about politics and about the issues. Now they can run ads around primary or general election time that mention a candidate for federal office. That was what McCain-Feingold made illegal, and that's the part of McCain-Feingold that was struck down. So what we can see now is that organizations that take a corporate form, businesses or nonprofit groups, including groups like the Sierra Club, for example, and also labor unions can now run ads during around elections that mention candidates for federal office. That is the only thing that changed.
So this opens the floodgates. It's a blow for democracy. John, you're saying it's not that big a deal.
Well, the flood metaphor, President Obama mentioned floodgates, that we're going to be overwhelmed. I mean, it seems to me that it is important to keep in mind that what this does is permit people to spend money on advertising that is on political speech. Justice Kennedy, in his majority opinion, said directly that this changes nothing at all about whether these groups, labor unions, corporations, and so on, can contribute money to candidates and to political parties. That is still illegal for them to do. So when you say floodgates, what you mean really is that you're going to have more ads and more political speech around election time. Now, if you think that's a bad thing, then it's a bad decision. But generally speaking, the evidence is, and the sort of constitutional faith we have in the United States, is that more speech is a good thing.
What do you think, Dan Weeks? What does this mean that businesses, unions, and nonprofits can do now that they couldn't do before?
If I could try to put this in perspective, for more than 100 years, it's been settled law in this country that we can place limits on the ability of corporations to spend their money to influence elections. A basic idea that when it comes to political campaigns and where our democracy is at issue, there are limits we can place on the ability of outside interest groups, including corporations, to influence those elections. This Supreme Court decision does a lot more than simply expand the time when outside interests can spend money. This overturns decades of precedents, including a 1993 decision in Austin, which said that corporations may directly spend out of their treasuries to influence the outcome of elections. In the past, they have had certain rights to participate in politics through their political action committees. Now they may spend directly from their treasuries, with trillions of dollars potentially available to spend on elections in order to influence elections. And this window in which they may spend, the McCain-Feingold law in 2002 said that in the run-up to elections, we may not have direct spending whose purpose is to influence elections. That's 3 months before the primary, 30 days before the general, 60 days before the primary. Now those groups may spend in that critical window unlimited sums to influence elections. And so I believe that this ruling has a lot more to do with intricacies of existing law. This overturns literally a century of precedent saying we can limit the ability of corporations to influence our democratic elections.
So not just McCain-Feingold, but a century of precedent, you're saying, Dan. It's indeed a big deal.
A very big deal. This is a shockwave for campaign finance reform in our basic democratic elections.
Well, I'm still confused, though, because you said, Dan, there are limits up until now. There are limits on outside groups and corporations and how much they can spend. Just watching the TV the days before the election, it doesn't seem like there's any limits. You're flooded with, you know, Sierra Club ads and National Rifle Association ads and tell congressman he's a bum and tell senator she's a rat. You know, it doesn't seem like there's any limits. It seems like the Wild West.
It is hard to imagine that there could be more political spending. And I can certainly sympathize with any voter who is fed up with this process. I am myself. But I think we need to consider where the money will be coming from. Today, there is at least a certain degree of disclosure, of accountability in terms of who is spending that money when it comes to advocating for the election or defeat of candidates. Tomorrow, now, after this law, there are no such limits. That money does not have to come in raised amounts through political action committees. It can directly advocate for or against candidates and come from corporate treasuries. And these are interested parties. They have a right to pursue their bottom line. But when it comes to influencing our policies and who gets elected in the first place, this is a real concern for our democracy.
John Samples, I know you wanted to jump in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to disagree about the interpretation of this, because at a certain level of abstraction, then you can say anything. And one of the memes going around here is that this overturns a century of a law. The century of law, you have to go back to limitations on campaign contributions by corporations, labor unions, and so on. And the labor unions is about a half century, a little more. That is not been overturned by this decision.
What this has is individual contributions. No, I want to give you $1 million. That's still the same. You can't do that.
Well, that's the same for individuals. There's a bunch of distinctions here that we sort of have to be aware of. And corporations and then later labor unions were prohibited and are prohibited from directly contributing to campaigns and to the political parties at this point. That part of McCain-Feingold reiterated that, and that's still good law. But the question of whether corporations, labor unions, and nonprofit groups could, independent of the parties and candidates, whether they could spend money to run ads and whether they could mention a federal candidate, those involve a Supreme Court decision of about 20 years old, and a law that's 7 or 8 years old. So I think we have to there's a sense of the one thing that's involved here is the distinctions the law makes, and we can disagree about that, and certainly the Supreme Court disagreed about some of those distinctions, whether there was going to be corruption caused by this and so on and so forth. But in fact, what actually happened was of much recent vintage, and arguably the Supreme Court decision itself was out of sync with other precedents that the Supreme Court in the majority of the Supreme Court believed that.
Gentlemen, lots to talk about, but let me also invite our listeners to join us at this point. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And today in the exchange, we're digging into the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that relaxed certain restrictions on the role corporations, unions, and nonprofits can play in political campaigns. Give us a call if you just want more information about what this means exactly, or if you want to comment on whether you think this ruling is a positive or negative development. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Dan Weeks, to you, let's just say that the decision went the other way, that it was 5-4 against Citizens United instead of 5-4 in favor. What would we see then on our TV airways before election time and in our email boxes and in our mailboxes at home?
That's a great question. Because I think we need to recognize that the status quo before Citizens United is very unsatisfactory. We already see enormous amounts of advertising. And even though there are these technical limits on what independent, including corporate money, can do in terms of directly advocating for the election or defeat of a candidate, we know that without using those magic words like vote for or vote against, these interests can still have a tremendous influence on our elections.
Give us an example.
Well, we saw in the recent Massachusetts special election, many outside interests on both sides of the aisle. Take, for example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce spent a couple of millions of dollars to advocate for, in this case, for the Senator-elect Brown and against his opponent. And this money, even though it did not contain those magic words, vote for or vote against, nonetheless had a significant influence on the election. I think anyone would agree in viewing those ads that they were intended to elect or defeat the candidate. And so as much as we are concerned about the Citizens United ruling as a real sort of landmark and pointing us in a very disconcerting direction for this court, because cases will follow to further undermine campaign finance law, as much as we're concerned about all of that, let me not say that the status quo before that ruling was acceptable. We need a really fundamental shift in our campaign finance laws.
Well, The Economist magazine said, I think, basically McCain-Feingold, I can't remember the exact words, but it's basically utterly failed, I think, is what The Economist called it. Do you agree with that, Dan?
I'd have to say that's a pretty fair observation.
We'll talk more after a short break and start taking your calls. If you're on the line, stay there. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email. Keep them short. The address, exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the future of elections in New Hampshire, given a recent Supreme Court decision allowing corporations, unions, and nonprofits a greater role in political campaigns. We invite you to join our conversation. Call in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests in studio, Dan Weeks, president of Americans for Campaign Reform, and in D.C., John Samples, director of the Center for Representative Government at the Cato Institute. And John, a real quick question for you before we go to the phones. We've talked a lot about corporate spending, nonprofit spending, but what about labor unions? How does this affect them, John? And why do you think labor leader Andy Stern called this a disaster for his movement?
Well, I'm a little surprised to hear that, actually, when you said it, because I know for a fact that the leading labor election lawyer was involved in and coordinating his amicus brief and took certain issues that represented the labor union point of view in favor of the decision that came down. That is, they were arguing against McCain-Feingold. And the reason is that over time they have in the past wanted to use this kind of to fund this kind of speech. And I suspect that the Stern is an outlier, and what you'll see is and was something more of a politically correct sort of statement, that what you'll see is labor unions very, in fact, my discussions the other day with someone who works for a business here in Washington said she thought that they expected that labor unions would move very quickly to utilize this freedom in the fall, and that businesses and corporations would stay clear for this 2010 election.
This is from Bloomberg News, quoting Andy Stern. He says, this is a moral disaster, a policy disaster, a practical disaster. He runs the 2.2 million member Service Employees International Union. He says, now we have the right to spend unlimited money. Unfortunately, we don't have unlimited money. Your thoughts on that, Dan, and then we'll go to our callers.
I would point out that today, at least, the amount of labor money in politics is about one-tenth of the amount of corporate money that's being spent both in the form of contributions and direct political spending. And so we are concerned about the ability of labor unions to spend as much money as they have to influence elections. But I think we do need to consider that it is a small fraction of the amount that those typically on the other side of these issues will be spending.
Lots of calls, gentlemen. Let's go to them. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. To Andover first, Dave's waiting. Hi, Dave, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just want to respond to Mr. Sample's point that he seemed to imply that we should take comfort that it's not as if the corporations are now okay to directly contribute to the campaigns. And I just think that that is a statement, a really naive statement, in the sense that the strategizing behind the scenes between campaigns and their donors and the different PACs and everything that run the messaging of these things is totally overseen by the campaign folks themselves. And so it's not as if that's a clean break. And so by this decision, the campaigns themselves are, depending on who they can ally themselves with, are now going to have unlimited funding for their messaging.
So, Dave, you're worried about this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in. What do you think, John Samples?
Well, as was pointed out and has been true by Justice Kennedy, has been true for a long time, what is asserted here is this sort of giant conspiracy is, in fact, illegal now. The campaign finance laws have coordination rules that prevent, that wall off expenditures from things that are coordinated with campaigns so that the expenditures don't come like contributions. Now, the people on the other side are going to say that's not going to work, as the gentleman just said. But, in fact, that is the law, and it's illegal to do it, and the people who are work with election lawyers are not going to be involved in that. My point is that the law itself will prevent that. So I don't think that is a big worry, unless you believe, and I think one of the things we should talk about here is that there's a larger sort of both partisan, ideological sort of background here, and also a sense that the current concern is primarily with corporations, and corporations serve a particular demon role in certain ideologies in America, and they're assumed to be, actors in politics that cause just enormous problems. Again, I point to the reality of it, and you could point to also academic studies of their spending in the PAC form, or even earlier when they could spend on issue ads, that they are not any more involved. They fight it out with the unions. The unions spent millions and millions of dollars in the 90s in ads that directly took on candidates. So the history, the actual practical reality, as opposed to the fears and the kinds of things that flow from a sort of demon perspective, I think are just wrong.
What do you think, Dan Weeks? And then we'll go back to our phones.
Yeah, if I could pick up on this key point of coordination of outside spending with campaigns, John Samples is indeed right that it is against the law to formally coordinate that spending. But you've got to ask yourself, how much of a separation is there really when the former chief of staff or the former campaign manager of a given Senate candidate is now running these independent expenditure campaigns? He may not be talking to the current campaign manager, but in point of fact, the spending that is conducted independently will be just as good as had it been spent by the campaign. So I think we operate under a certain false comfort when we look at our campaign finance laws and see, well, there is this separation or they may not directly contribute to campaigns. That's important. It's not worth nothing, but let's not assign it more worth than it is. And that is when you have these independent groups run by the same individuals who previously ran the campaigns, spent on behalf of those candidates, even if they can't directly contribute that money to the candidates. This is influence peddling out and out. This is a way of influencing elections to advance a certain agenda, and its consequences for a basic democratic principle that the people rule, not special interest groups, the consequences are very, very grave.
Well, despite those concerns, Dan, some analysts, more than one, say, hey, this is not that big a deal. Widely quoted has been a Mr. Stephen Weissman, who up until now ran an institute on campaign finance at George Washington University, my alma mater, by the way. He said existing restrictions are already so lax that the ruling will likely have little practical effect. So I hear that you're concerned in theory, Dan, but in practicality, as we said at the beginning of the show, we're already flooded with these things.
That's a great point. You can say the shack of campaign finance laws is pretty darn rickety as it stands today. And arguably, we ought to just burn it down and rebuild. And I think that is, as we move towards solutions to this problem, that is just what we need to do.
Well, and I'll ask you what solutions your group is advocating. But I want to go back to the calls, gentlemen. Dave, thanks for that call. Next up is Dominic in Ringe. Hi, Dominic. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I basically have 2 points. One, boy, if I owned a media outlet, a newspaper or a station or something like that, I love this because I'm going to make a ton of money every time one of these political campaigns come around, because that's what all this money is spent on. But I personally am in my 60s. I have voted in every election since I was able to, have never missed one, and have never paid attention to a political ad, brochure, or anything in my entire life. In fact, when they start turning negative, first of all, I go out of my way to turn them off, change the channel or whatever. But if they go negative and I can't avoid them, that actually turns me off more than it does influence me to vote in a direction.
So, Dominic, it doesn't have any impact on you, so more won't have any impact on you. That's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Well,
but I think that they should throw the entire system out, put forth a certain amount of money that each candidate can spend, throw all the outside influences out, limit it to that amount of money, either that or donate the time equally to all candidates, and just go that way.
Well, thanks for calling, Dominic. John Samples, what do you think about his first point that, you know, it doesn't really affect him?
Well, it's a good point because it does point to an underlying assumption here, which is that what is involved here is not Dan Week's nebulous influence, but actually permission for funding that protected speech. And that so there'll be more speech. And the assumption is that people will either ignore it or assess it, or if they wish to be influenced with it, they'll conclude it's the right speech. That's the assumption underneath the First Amendment, that we're better off in the long run by permitting speech rather than letting government, Congress in this case, decide who gets to speak and how much.
Well, John,
and
has
so
anybody,
that's what happened in this case.
Has anybody done any research, John, on at what point you reach the saturation point and the advertising has no impact?
A man named John Coleman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison has studied elections in the past. And what he found two things about it. One is that more high-spending campaigns tend to result in better-informed voters. And more importantly, maybe, also high-spending campaigns lead to more returns. That is, the people who start off badly informed gain more from the high-spending campaigns in terms of being informed about the candidates than people who are always already informed, the people with that are going to tend to have lots of information like higher education or higher income. So, no, there's no indication of that more is worse. To the contrary, there's solid social science that indicates more spending is a good thing and leads to better informed voters.
Dan, what do you think?
Great. If you'll actually permit me to agree with John here on 2 points, I think the first is yes, and I fully respect, as much as we've disagreed in the first half hour of this show, I fully respect where John and the Cato Institute are coming from on the beauty of the First Amendment and the importance of respecting, cherishing, expanding the First Amendment. The fundamental concern we have here is let's be sure that not only the wealthy interests, be they corporate, be they well-endowed unions, whoever they may be, let's be sure that they're not the only ones who can speak and be heard in this democracy of ours. We say let the independent group speak, but let's be sure that those without access to tremendous amounts of wealth can speak as well. And that's where the solution which we advocate in voluntary public funding comes forward. And I hope we'll get to that shortly.
Well, and that's Dominic's second point. He says, you know, burn the shack down and let's start over. So go ahead. How do you start over, Dan?
Well, once again, we've been through a year of tremendously trying policy debates on one issue after another. But I think we had a reminder just 2 weeks ago on the anniversary of President Obama's inauguration, a jolt in the Massachusetts election to the Democrats, where we really saw, if we didn't know already, that the American people are pretty fed up with politics as usual, as we like to call it. And we were reminded that in his campaign, President Obama said in every stump speech he gave, yeah, we need to address these policies, healthcare, the environment, jobs, you name it. But in order to do so, we need to change our politics, the way we do business in this country. And that is where the solution which we're advocating for comes in. That is, let's fundamentally change, let's rebuild the House of Campaign Finance Reform and fundamentally change the way business is done in Washington by addressing, for the first time in 100 years since we started campaign finance reform, by addressing the source of the money, where the money is coming from, not just how it can be given, at what stage in the campaign, in what limits, and how one can circumvent that, but where it comes from in the first place, because it is still the status quo. It has been since campaign finance began that the vast majority of money funding our campaigns is private. It comes from about 0.25% of the population, more than 80% of the money, from a small fraction of 1% of our people. And if we're going to fundamentally change this system and rebuild this house, we need to go to a much more broad-based system in the Fair Elections Now Act currently being considered by the Congress, which takes small citizen donations from a broad base of a candidate's constituents and then matches them with public funds derived by assessing a small fee on large-scale government contractors. It's not actually taxpayer money. It's money which the government collects from major government contractors to match the small donations of citizens so that, in a very literal sense, we the people own our politicians. We own the elections.
So everybody, and I don't want to get too much into detail right now because I want to get John's thoughts on this, but under this system, could anybody who raised X number of small donations get matching public funds?
If a candidate can show they're serious, and it's got to be a tough qualifier because we don't want to give this money away to non-credible candidates. But if you're a hardworking and a serious candidate, and in the case of House candidates, if you can raise at least 1,500 donations within your state from your constituents in amounts of up to $100 apiece, you may begin to receive, we're not going to give you large lump sums, but you may begin to receive matching public funds so that you can compete with the outside groups and we can have more speech under the First Amendment.
Well, and John, I want to bring you into this, and you and I have talked about this before. Real quickly, John, your thoughts on small donations and matching public funds and whether that would truly, as they say, level the playing field.
Well, I'm sorry to hear Dan say that taxpayer money is not going to be involved because, of course, that's not true. If you look at – you have to ask yourself, why is it that they're hiding the fact that taxpayers are going to have to pay for public financing? An increase in taxes on defense contractors is going to just be passed along in the cost of defense, and so will lead to increased taxes. So it's obscured here. Why is that? And it's because most people don't like the idea that the government in public financing is going to compel them to contribute to campaigns or political parties that they don't want to contribute to. That if someone raises $50,000 and gets $1.5 million, most of that $1.5 million is going to come from somewhere. And it's going to be the taxpayers. And yes, the money might be small, but I think most people object to the idea they have to. If you look at the presidential system, for example, it's designed to try to avoid the idea that taxpayers are compelled to make just such a contribution. This system, the problem with that is people then don't check the box and the system begins to run out of money. So I think that's the major issue here, not small versus big or those kinds of issues. I will say this, that Dan's proposal in the Fair Elections Now differs from many past kinds of campaign finance regulation, which tried to, for example, prevent people from running ads 30 or 60 days before elections. They are a just say no kinds of regulations that are incompatible with the First Amendment. Dan is proposing essentially a subsidy with very few regulations on people not participating in the system. So I will say, and I've said in congressional testimony, if Dan's bill were passed, you would see more candidates running against members of the House of Representatives, and they would be speaking inevitably more because you would have more candidates. The problem is not really with competition and other issues. I think the problem is the one I mentioned of compulsion.
This is the problem that's always come up with public financing, Dan. If John is a committed Republican, he doesn't want tax money going to Democrats.
And I think it's a fair point. Once again, I would point out that this is not taxpayer money, even if there are indirect costs. But I think the more fundamental point is it is public money. It is money which we could use for other purposes. And I respect those who say, I don't want my money to go to this cause. I would ask them, however, what price are you willing to pay for the system as we have it today? And the reason that our effort is a truly bipartisan one, we're chaired by former New Hampshire Senator Warren Rudman, along with Senators Bill Bradley, Bob Kerry, and Al Simpson, and have support from dozens of former Republican members of the House and Senate. The reason it is so bipartisan is because from a conservative perspective, we see tremendous amounts of waste that follow from the current system. If you are an interest group able to influence the regulations under which you operate, you are going to seek special privileges. You are going to seek favorable tax regulations, which in the aggregate, or earmarks, which add up to tens of billions of dollars per year, as compared with the cost of this system that is much, much less. And so it is a sensible way from fiscal policy, but it is also a way to ensure that the democracy is indeed in the hands of the people.
Lots of calls, gentlemen. We'll go to them after a break. If you're on the line, hang on. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
When you can, I think it's important to support those organizations who support you and support your quality of life. And we are very excited about New Hampshire Public Radio and feel that there's a great need to have that option for a new source. And so I decided to step up and become a member of the Leadership Circle, and I intend to remain there. I'm Mary Cowan, and I live in Hopkinton.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Commissioner Nick Tumpas of New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services joins us. Email us your questions and concerns for the commissioner before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And then join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, the future of campaign finance after a major U.S. Supreme Court decision 2 weeks ago. We welcome your thoughts in our conversation. 1-800-892-6477 or email us exchange@nhpr.org. And John Samples at the Cato Institute, Dan Weeks at Americans for Campaign Finance Reform. Let's go back to our callers. In Chester, Karen is on the line. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to go back to something you were saying well before the break about more speech meaning more information. And I guess I have a different spin on it. I think that more speech also results in more misinformation. And I'm wondering how your guests feel about the actual result of that flood of information and misinformation. And I'm thinking in my own experience, the more misinformation I see, the more savvy I have to become in order to wade through it and make sense of it. So it seems to me that either voters would just back out of the process and just say, I can't make sense of it at all, I'm not even going to vote or participate, or it could just make us all more savvy and more critical in considering our sources. Sort in the way, same way that the internet has even forced school children to really think about their sources and say, where is this coming from? And does that mean that it's correct, or is there possibly a spin on it?
So in your mind, Karen, more is not necessarily a bad thing?
No.
Okay. What do you think, John Samples?
Well, first of all, Karen, wow, what a real reasoned and analytic call. That's great. The point I would make about misinformation is this. We don't know from the start when we're making regulations what bad speech is. Sometimes I get on with conservative radio shows and they say, well, so-and-so was lying. And, you know, how can that happen? Why don't the campaign finance laws do something about that? Well, the decision here, because we have a First Amendment that mentions speech but not speakers, is to try to, this is the John Stuart Mill thing, we're trying to determine what truth is, and the alternative is to say, well, there's bad speech, there's lies, or so on, and we're going to let Congress or the government decide what can't be said to begin with. And, of course, that's exactly the wrong place to put it for a variety of reasons, but above all because Congress has a tremendous conflict of interest. If they can reduce the amount of competition, the amount of challengers through, you know, regulating funding of elections, they're going to do it. Congress, the ones who would be deciding what misinformation is, are both the referee and the player in the game of elections, and they're not likely to be disinterested and concerned with the public interest in making these kinds of regulations about so-called misinformation.
Now, Karen mentioned the Internet, and Dan Weeks, not in this context, but I did want to ask you about the Internet. How much does the advent and success of Internet fundraising, where you can raise a lot through many small donations, such as President Obama did in 07 and 08, how much does that ease your fears that only the big guys are getting their voices heard?
It is certainly a positive step for our democracy. And it is, in fact, part of the motivation that we have in moving toward a system that's driven by small donors. Because for the first time, it seems conceivable that we could have small donors providing the lion's share of funds. But I think we have to be realistic about where we are today. President Obama deserves a lot of credit for raising an unprecedented number of individual donations over the Internet. But at the end of the day, the money he raised in small amounts from donors giving less than $200 was only about a quarter of the total money that he raised. And so the vast majority of those funds were still large donations. And he has acknowledged, as others have acknowledged, that has a compromising influence on their ability to really independently consider the best policies for the country. If I can just respond to John's other point in bringing in John Stuart Mill, I think it is a critical one with which I agree that the government should not be in the business of regulating the content of speech. I do think we should be concerned with a situation today where, again, a fraction of 1% of the people are providing the vast majority of the funds that go to put our politicians in office. And we should be concerned as a response to that to ensuring that those aren't the only voices that can get on the air. Hence, a small donor system of matching public funds to enable other candidates, as we're seeing in several states across the country that have voluntary public funding, much more competition, more voices getting heard, and thus the voters, the students in their classrooms can actually judge between different and competing voices as opposed to having to always find that this voice is a partial one and there is no alternative to compete with it.
Karen, thanks a lot for that call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Gentlemen, I have another question that came up earlier in my mind when we were talking about whether corporations or nonprofits could coordinate with political campaigns or not. And you both said the law says they can't, although Dan said that, you know, under the table, they could. I have a question for you, John Samples. Could a corporation set up not just TV and radio ads or emails, but set up a phone banking operation and basically run a parallel campaign funded by that one company? Could they do that?
In terms of, I don't know about the phone bank. This is
you know, door to door, phone banks, and so forth.
But they could certainly run a this clears the way where. And it's unlikely that a single corporation would do it, but I think, because for a variety of reasons I could go into, but I think they could certainly run a series of advertisements and mention various candidates. One thing we're not hasn't been mentioned at this point, and I find in my discussions with people who do this sort of thing for corporations, is they are, in fact, limited in what they can do in politics because they have to be aware of. They have customers, they have people they work with that might not like their positions and can. There's a cost to be paid there. They have shareholders who, particularly in times like this, the thing I keep hearing is about the economy with corporations spending money on political ads now, political campaigns, and this kind of economy is shareholders are not going to like that, and you pay a price at the stock price. So there's probably a wide range of things they could do. What they're actually going to do, I think, is very different.
So they might not want to offend customers on the political right or the political left by coming out in front on a particular issue. So you're saying there's a disincentive for them to get highly involved.
And remember, Kennedy also said in Citizens United that the disclosure laws are upheld for these ads.
Another question for both of you before we go back to the phones. Dan Weeks, what happens now, given this ruling, to the involvement of foreign companies in funding advocacy ads during a U.S. political campaign?
This is not a question which the court directly spoke to, but it is the opinion of many legal analysts who have looked at the decisions and looked at existing law that even though foreign individuals and entities cannot contribute directly to political campaigns, there is nothing in this ruling or in the interpretation of existing law that says it would not be possible for American subsidiaries of foreign companies to spend independently to influence elections. Now, I hope there would not be much of this kind of spending, but I'm deeply concerned about the possibility and about not seeing limitations. This is something the Congress and the President are looking into, and I hope it will be addressed, but it is just one example of the potentially very negative ramifications of this ruling.
John Samples, real quick, your thoughts on foreign contributions and then back to our phones.
I guess the fundamental difference when you talk about influence versus speech, if you have a foreign country in or foreign nationals influencing American policy, the assumption is they're not doing it for the good of the country. However, I can't imagine situations where foreigners or foreign nationals, and remember, foreign companies now can take ads out to try to speak to Americans about political issues, not election ads. But I can imagine cases where we need to hear from them. For example, if our trade policy is going to cut off and kill jobs in some of the poorest countries in the world, we would want to hear about that, I think, and it would be good for voters to hear from it. There's an anti-foreign bias here that's in the public that President Obama is playing on now that is truly disturbing.
It is difficult to imagine, though, that the people of Darfur, of Mozambique, you name it, would actually have the funds to be running political ads. Instead, who would have those money? It might be PetroChina. It might be major interests. So I'm not terribly optimistic that foreign money would serve to broaden our consciousness and raise our minds to the suffering of other people. I think rather it would be corporate money trying to influence elections.
Could I make a point?
Ways. Yeah, real quick, John, and then I want to take a
call. The difference is Dan focuses on speakers and says there's speakers that threaten America. I focus on speech and tend to see speech as a good thing. And if you don't like the speech, then just ignore it.
It is certainly a good thing.
Let's go to Len in Springfield, Vermont. Hi, Len. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead. Oh, we lost Len there. I hope that he calls back. You know, looking ahead, gentlemen, and I'll turn to you first, Dan. What do you think Congress is going to do next on this? President Obama urged Congress to pass laws that he said would, quote, mute the ill effects of this.
There are a number of solutions being considered as we speak. I'll be in Washington this week where hearings are getting underway in several House and Senate committees to look at different responses to this. What we have been disappointed to see in much of the rhetoric, though not all of it, is that we're seeing a lot of piecemeal incremental fixes to do with shareholder limits on ways of curtailing the spending by those corporations, to do with limiting foreign money in American elections. And these are valid concerns, but they do not get at the heart of the problem. The one solution which does have, at this point, the most support in Congress, the Fair Elections Now Act for voluntary public funding of campaigns, is supported by more than 130 members of Congress as co-sponsors. That's a bipartisan set of co-sponsors, and that is currently in committee and is also being debated. And we are certainly working with citizens around the country to be sure that this is the solution which moves forward, because it is the only way, if we take the long-term view, it is the only way of addressing these fundamental concerns about who gets to speak and be heard in our democracy.
And John, what do you think is going to happen next as a result of this?
I think a lot depends on what happens as we go up toward the elections. Frankly, just to give a political view of it, which in most things in this town, in Washington where I am, are partisan political, this comes at a time when Democrats are enjoying a considerable advantage in fundraising. And that's that was not true until 2000, but since 2000, Democrats have been even with Republicans, or since 2004, really have outraised the Republican Party. And right now they enjoy a considerable advantage. If clearly Charles Schumer and others believe that this will work against that, this decision. If it doesn't, I think you'll have a lot of Sturm und Drang for the next few weeks, and then probably nothing will happen in the end. It's a very – the Justice Kennedy's majority decision is, you know, very clear. It's going to be hard to get around.
Let's go to Heartland, Vermont next. Andy's waiting there. Hi, Andy. Go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Laura. I wanted to mention that I've been a lawyer and a publisher for a long career, and I've been both inside and outside of large corporations dealing with them. And the truth is that corporations do not behave like people. And I think cannot be treated as people. They aren't as honest as people. They have different motives than people. Even though they're made up of people, the people collectively within corporations don't behave the way they would if they were individuals. And the result is that they don't really follow moral codes. Their code is to make maximum profits, and that leads them in different directions.
So they should not be treated.
I think it's an awful mistake to treat them as people.
This gets into, John, a fundamental debate. Corporations, should they be treated like individuals who have free speech?
Well, to my mind, this is the most fundamental thing that's come out of this decision. One view of the Constitution, the First Amendment, is you ask the question, and this is what Justice Kennedy asked, does the Constitution give the government the power to do something? He looked and remember, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. It doesn't say except for speech from a certain this kind of speaker or that kind of speaker or untrue speech and so on. It says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Kennedy concluded that this abridged freedom of speech, McCain-Feingold and so on, and that the government didn't have the power. There's a different view of the Constitution, which says that the Constitution creates a government that has complete power, and then you go back and pull out really exceptions or loopholes. There's a loophole in the First Amendment for individuals speaking, but not a loophole for other kind of entities speaking. And it's because, as the gentleman said, usually these arguments are the entities are in some way inferior or bad for the society. But that's a notion of that it really has a government with plenary power with exceptions. Kennedy, it seems to me, is really along the lines of the original notion of the Constitution, which is a government of limited and defined powers, and the First Amendment simply states those limits and definitions.
You know, given this ruling, Dan Weeks, you mentioned the various campaign finance bills in the works, small ones that do nip and tuck, and then, of course, the big one that you want that would rely on small donations with matching public funds. But given this ruling that we've been talking about this hour, what are the chances that any new laws, such as the ones you support, would also be overturned, given the precedent that this decision sets up?
That's a great question. We have, as I think I mentioned earlier, for a century, we have tried one form of campaign finance reform, which is basically, in one way or another, to limit political speech under the First Amendment. And as John has been at pains to point out, that is a troubling course. And if for no other reason than the practical fact that we have a 5-member conservative majority on the court, those kinds of approaches will not stand. But to your question about the constitutionality of this public funding approach under the Fair Elections Now Act, the courts have continually upheld these approaches for a simple reason. They are voluntary. We let the independent groups speak, let them spend their money, but let's be sure they're not the only ones who can speak in our democracy. Thus, if a candidate can qualify, raise matching small donations, they can also compete, and they accept the limits voluntarily as a condition for participation in the program. So the court has continually upheld these systems. We believe they would see it as cherishing and expanding the First Amendment.
John Samples, what do you think? Would the courts back up a law such as this?
I think given the precedents we have, yes, that's correct. And particularly because this one is doing less about people who aren't participating in the programs. The one exception I would say is it's pretty clear that, and I think they've taken it out, any effort to fund people who face independent spending or so on, all of that is unconstitutional. You can't add money. But No, I think in general this would be upheld. For some reason, the Supreme Court hasn't taken my position about compulsion of speech.
And, John, I got to cut you off there in the interest of time. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it, John.
Thanks a lot.
And Dan Weeks, thank you for coming in as well.
Thanks for having me.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Sarah Crane. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.